from WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Lehman Brothers collapsed 5 years ago this week. 5 years on, after the Great Recession, all the pain, the bank bailouts, and big calls for Wall Street reform, the passage of Dodd-Frank, are we better protected, safe from a repeat? We've got two top experts on the crisis and financial markets now with us. This hour on Point, we look at where we are 5 years after the fall of Lehman Brothers. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in this country's response to the wild Wall Street behavior and collapse that sank so much of the economy? Have we changed? Could it happen again? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from San Francisco is Bethany McLean, contributing editor to Vanity Fair, columnist for Reuters, contributor to CNBC, one of the country's hottest financial journalists. She is co-author with New York Times columnist Joe Nocera of All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. Bethany McLean, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
And with me from Princeton, New Jersey, is Alan Blinder, celebrated professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He served under President Clinton on the Council of Economic Advisers and then as chairman of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. He is author of After the Music Stopped, The Financial Crisis, The Response, and the Work Ahead. Alan Blinder, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Let's go back for just a moment to Monday, September 15th, 2008, after a long weekend and the failure of Lehman Brothers, then Secretary of the Treasury, Henry Paulson, assured reporters that America would be okay, despite the fact that these were tough times.
We're working through a difficult period in our financial markets right now as we work off some of the past excesses. But the American people can remain confident in the soundness and the resilience of our financial system.
Well, not that confident, it turned out. And within a couple of days, that was clearer than ever. The president, President Bush, spoke a couple of days later, September 19th, 2008, from the White House. He asked Americans to put aside debating the origins of the problem until another day, and for that moment, to come together to confront the continuing, then continuing crisis.
Our system of free enterprise rests on the conviction that the federal government should interfere in the marketplace only when necessary. Given the precarious state of today's financial markets and their vital importance to the daily lives of the American people, government intervention is not only warranted, it is essential.
Not only warranted, but essential. And in they came, history made. Andrew Ross Sorkin reminds us in the Times of all that followed Merrill Lynch's hasty sale to Bank of America, the bailout of AIG, the breaking of the buck on the money market, the near collapse of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley that led them to become banking holding companies, and the decision by the government to pursue the $700 billion troubled asset relief program to bail out the entire banking industry. Bethany McLean, take us back. What happened to Lehman Brothers that put it over the edge?
Well, that's still a good question even today, because in the end, the crisis was more one of illiquidity than it was of insolvency, although I think there's still a debate whether Lehman was really insolvent or just illiquid. What happened was the buildup of toxic mortgage assets in the system caused everybody to lose faith in the financial markets all at once, and deep plumbing of the financial system, including a deep plumbing known as the repo market, simply froze up, and suddenly firms like Lehman that had depended on the willingness of others to finance them could not get any financing. So it was basically an enormous crisis of confidence in the U.S. financial markets.
A frightening financial meltdown, you write, Alan Blinder, and of course we all know that. We want to look at what's happened since then, but how do you look back, Alan, and characterize the years running up to that historic collapse and what was going on that set us up for the collapse?
Well, I think that's, of course, a long question, but I think the short of it is we threw a big national party in the financial system. The center was mortgages and especially securities based on mortgages, including some wild and woolly derivatives that were written on those securities. Plus, in great contradiction to the old aphorism that the Federal Reserve, and by the way, other regulators, but yes, especially the Federal Reserve, is around to take away the punch bowl when the party starts going good, the Fed did not take away the punch bowl by by any means, and the Federal Reserve and other regulators, including the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, just sort of look the other way and let it all happen based, I think, on catching some of the euphoria and also an excessive belief in laissez-faire. Let the market alone.
Alan Blinder, put it in perspective for us, because, you know, things that happen in our lifetimes can seem mundane even when they're not. I mean, this was huge and painful, but, you know, people say we came within a hair's breadth of going into a global Great Depression. Just how big a deal was this?
This is about as big, unless you can remember the 1920s and then leading into the 1930s, this is about as big a deal as there's been in your lifetime, or likely in your whole lifetime if you're a young person. A very big deal indeed. Now, you mentioned that we almost went into a global depression. We did go into a global recession.
Yes.
In many, many countries in the world, including our own, this was the most severe recession since the 1930s. And that's not just true in the United States of America. That's even after we did all these things to try to save the situation from becoming even worse. So just imagine if the government, and by the way, again, it wasn't just the U.S. government, it was governments around the world, hadn't done some of the things that they did do.
All the bailouts and stimulus and on and on and on and on, $85 billion a month still by the Fed.
And it was unpopular stuff. I mean, you know, if Americans had been given a referendum on whether we should bail out these various banks and Wall Street firms, you know it would have failed. And no doubt, I think in retrospect, it would fail today. I mean, you can still see some polling about that. So a lot of people had to take a lot of very tough decisions and, in some cases, very tough votes in the Congress, like on the TARP that you mentioned.
Yeah, the bailout. Bethany McLean, you and Joe Nocera turned to Shakespeare to find a sufficient kind of line to describe this back to The Tempest. Hell is empty and all the devils are here. All the devils are here, the title of your book. Who's that referring to, Bethany?
I think Joe and I were trying to do justice to the idea that the cause of this crisis wasn't one simple thing. In the wake of something like this, we always want to find the villain, the bad guy who did it all. And in truth, this crisis was a confluence of wrongdoing by a lot of people, from these new breed of mortgage originators, mostly based out in California, who would make a loan to anybody with a pulse, or in some cases without a pulse, to Wall Street, which was so eager to make money that they packaged up these bad mortgages and sold them on to investors, pretending they didn't know what was happening, and to regulators who looked the other way, and to Congress, who refused to rein in subprime lending despite the mounting evidence that people were getting loans that they couldn't pay back. So we wanted to do justice to this idea that there were a lot of causes of this crisis. You can't find one single bad guy.
Alan Blinder, we're going to look in this hour at how we have responded to this incredible, profound, historic crisis. Benchmark us in broad stroke with what this country, our country, did in the 1930s after the 1929 collapse to respond to the mayhem of the 20s.
Well, I think there were probably, I can think off the top of my head of two different ways to benchmark it. There were probably 12 others.
Yeah.
But one, you could think about how much money, how much taxpayer money was put at risk. I use that phrase advisedly, at risk, because the risks all turned out well for the taxpayers.
Are you talking this time or in the 30s?
Well, what I was going to say is this time it was vastly more than in the 30s.
To keep us from tipping into a Great Depression.
Yes.
In the 30s, we were not kept from tipping into a depression, but we did respond to what had happened in 1929.
Now,
lay that out.
That's the other metric. Mm-hmm. So we did better in sort of preventing the worst from happening, whereas in the 30s, we did poorly from preventing the worst from happening.
Mm-hmm.
The other metric is the response. After the 1930s, during the 1930s, when Roosevelt became president, we took in fairly short order a number of very drastic legislative steps that absolutely transformed the financial system and the financial regulatory system. So just to name a few, there was the Glass-Steagall Act. There was starting the FDIC. There was starting the SEC. There was the Homeowners Loan Corporation to prevent foreclosures. There was the Federal Home Loan Bank System started. And shortly after that, Fannie Mae. You have to sort of laugh at that, because Fannie Mae came back to haunt us later. And I'm leaving out a few things. I mean, these were incredible changes in the financial system.
So we're going to dive into what we did this time, but as a broad comparison, how is the vigor and health of our response to the crisis this time compared to that in the 30s?
Well, as I was saying, I think the vigor in the instant while things were going to hell in a handbasket was much greater this time around.
So kudos on that front.
Yes, but then the vigor in sort of fixing up the problems, okay? Weaknesses have been pointed out, even shady things have been pointed out. What are we going to do about it? I think the vigor in the 1930s was vastly greater.
Bethany, why do you think that is? Why would we have, I mean, good thing, people stepped in and kept us from tipping into full-on depression, but why haven't we come back and fixed these things? They did. The fixes lasted 75 years.
Maybe they're part and parcel of the same thing in the sense that because it did appear that we fixed things by intervening so dramatically and bringing the financial system back from the cliff, it was easy to argue, oh, we don't need to do anything else. Whereas in the 1930s, the effects of the Great Depression continued to be felt not just by citizens, but by people at every level of society. Here, the well-off have rebounded quite quickly. And I do think it's interesting when you look back. I don't criticize what people did in the height of the crisis to save the financial system. It's easy to second guess those decisions, but I think people acted in the heat of the moment and did save the financial system and probably the economy with it.
Bethany, in a word, are we at risk of it happening again?
I think we are because no one understands our big banks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's been cleaned up on Wall Street and what very definitely has not. 5 years after the shocking collapse of Lehman Brothers and the beginning of the Great Recession, Bethany McLean is with us from San Francisco, co-author of All the Devils Are Here, The Hidden History of the Financial Crisis. Alan Blinder is here from Princeton. He was on President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisor, was chairman of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve System, author of After the Music Stopped. President Obama on Sunday, in an interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos, saying, you know, things were a mess. He took office, the economy stabilized, and now it's growing.
We came in, stabilized the situation. We've now had 42 straight months of growth, 7.5 million new jobs created, 500,000 jobs in manufacturing, 370,000 jobs in an auto industry that had completely collapsed. The banking system works. It is giving loans to companies who can get credit. And so we have seen, I think, undoubtedly, progress across the board.
Stepped in, stabilized things. Alan Blinder gives the president and his crew credit for that. No mean feat. It could have been really very much worse. But have we really cleaned it up? Here's Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, Monday interview with Fox Business Network, saying at a very basic level, no.
We've still got work to do, and too big to fail is at the heart of it. The four largest financial institutions in this country are 30% bigger than they were just 5 years ago. The five largest financial institutions now hold more than 50% of all banking assets. That puts our entire economy at risk. It's too much concentration in the system.
So join us this hour. After all the pain and loss and suffering of jobs and houses and hope, why is Wall Street unreformed? Still too big to fail. Bethany, I'm looking here on Dodd-Frank. Of course, this is lots and lots of talk about Dodd-Frank for years, but here we are all these years later, passed in 2010, but only, 38-39% of the rules there have been implemented, finished even, and more than 60% of the deadlines for Dodd-Frank missed, and people saying it doesn't really hit the big, baddest targets anyway.
Well, I do think the big problem, I agree that too big to fail is still a problem, but I almost think the bigger problem, no pun intended, is too big to understand. And you can see by the events that happened at J.P. Morgan when it lost $6 billion in this derivative trade, and just today new criminal charges were filed yesterday, that even regulators and top managers at these big banks can't always understand the complexities of their firm. And I do think that we should have taken a deep breath in the wake of the crisis and said, what is the modern financial system that best meets the needs of consumers and businesses? How do we structure it? Because you need a functioning financial system to have a functioning economy. The financial system is like the substrata of the economy. And a financial system that is mired in new regulation that is 40% complete is just not good news for any of us.
So, Alan Blinder, walk us through some of the big pieces that have been touched but not really handled, not really taken care of.
Well, there's a long, long list. So let me start with too big to fail and disagree a little bit. This is a nuance, but an important nuance of disagreement with both Bethany and Elizabeth Warren on the tape. Too big to fail has been taken care of if the law works as written and promulgated in the regulation.
How?
Now, that's a potentially big if, right? So the Dodd-Frank law basically ends too big to fail by providing the third way that Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson back in 2008 were bemoaning the lack of. That is, they said they had the choice between using public money to bail out Lehman Brothers and sending it to bankruptcy court. There is now a third way in Dodd-Frank, I think it's Title I or Title II, orderly liquidation authority. And a few months ago, the FDIC finally, that's not a criticism, this is a hard job, issued details of how they would actually put to rest in a peaceful way a gigantic financial institution should the need arise. Now, that's on paper.
And meaning what? That it would go out of business and thereby...
It would go out of business slowly. So in the beginning, the government comes in, it steps in somewhat like it does when a bank fails, a simple bank. FDIC has been handling those for, you know, since the 30s. And what it generally does is come in on Friday at the close of business, put a lock on the door, send its people in, either find a buyer or put in some public money. No depositor basically no depositor loses a nickel. The guarantee is only the insured depositors, but mostly no one loses a nickel. And they open it up against Monday. Now, as Bethany was intimating, these financial giants are much too complicated for that.
Yeah.
So the FDIC has put out, it runs to several hundred pages, a blueprint of how it will act in an analogous but certainly not identical way for a financial giant. And, you know, then we're going to have to, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating whenever we have to eat something like that. Hopefully it won't be for a long
time. But would it be... So it would keep us from having this choice of, you know, full-on panic and collapse or bankruptcy, nothing. Would it have enough teeth in it, enough pain in it for the bankers that it would put the fear of failure into them? I mean, you just wrote, far from being tamed, the financial beast has gotten its mojo back and is winning.
Right. I was referring to other things when I come to in a second. But on this one, I think the answer is yes, because part of the solution is to wipe out the shareholders and throw out the managers.
So, Bethany, too big to fail, not a problem? Senator Warren's wrong?
I actually disagree that it will work, and here's why. I think it would work if there were one institution that ran into trouble. There might be a good chance of having the provisions in Dodd-Frank work exactly as Professor Blinder just explained.
Yes.
But usually when you have a problem, you have a systemic problem like we had in the fall of 2008, and it affects all the big financial institutions. And I do not see a conceivable way that you can enact this resolution authority for all of those institutions at the same time. So I think I totally agree the proof will be in the pudding. We'll have to see what happens if this happens again.
I mean, it's not really the answer we want, difficult. Right? When the pudding is so potentially lethal, that's really not the proof will be in the pudding when it happens again. I mean, we'd like to be surer than that.
No, you would, but, you know, just like in automobile and aircraft safety and things, you only really know when you confront an emergency how well it's going to work. You know, I would sort of strengthen Bethany's point. We're not even sure it'll work for one institution until we try it. But my point was that the mechanism is, the legal mechanisms are now in place, which this is a big change from five years ago.
So we have an option if there are failures, but we don't want the failures. We want to set it up so that's less likely. What do you mean when you write, far from being tamed, the financial beast has gotten its mojo back and is winning?
Okay, I'll give you a few examples. Derivatives, which were left completely unregulated by an act of Congress in 2000, a horrible act of Congress in 2000, are now incipiently under a serious regulatory regime. Now, the key word is incipiently. Gary Gensler, who heads the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which is the principal regulator of these things, has been fighting a battle with seemingly everybody to put a serious regulatory regime in place. Some of that resistance has come from the United States Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it has come from the banking lobby, which is powerful. This is the big banks.
Yep.
The little banks are not in that kind of business. Some of it has come from foreign governments and foreign regulators who resent America's big footprint on this, or America trying to make such a big footprint.
Why are you optimistic? Gensler's been shouting on top of his lungs that it doesn't seem to be going well.
I mean, I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal recently joining the shouting with Gensler.
Yeah.
You know, a main reason, I believe, for the difficulties we're having in implementing parts of Dodd-Frank is that as the crisis recedes and as it moves out of the Congress, there was a big battle to pass Dodd-Frank, into the shadows of the regulatory commissions, which are open in a sense, but the people are not paying attention. The lobbyists are paying rapt attention.
And they're loaded.
And they are loaded, and they are all over every adjective and adverb in the regulations, and it makes for a very unfair fight. And so some of these are dying or withering, I guess I should say, on the regulatory vine. Another great example is what's called the skin in the game requirement for securitizers. What does that mean? The securitizers, these are largely the Wall Street firms, were taking these crummy mortgages, packaging them into securities, and selling them to, you know, pick your adjective, unwary, stupid, uninformed investors, whatever. There were some of each kind. And they were selling the whole thing, or if they could.
Here, take this junk.
Take this junk. The skin in the game requirement requires them to hold on to 5% themselves. Now, to me, 5% was too little, but that's what passed Congress. But now that is being totally eviscerated in the regulatory process by the banks arguing there's a provision in the law that the really safe mortgages that nobody's worried about shouldn't be subject to this 5%. Well, now the question is, how do you define that? And one of the suggestions that I'm afraid is going to win the day exempts 95% of all mortgages. Think about that.
So skin in the game, but 95% of all mortgages, no skin in the game, not required.
Yes, so I don't think that's very good. So I was screaming about that in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of examples like that.
We've got more to look at on derivatives, Bethany. I mean, Alan Blinder sees incipient regulatory regime. But, you know, incipient's a funny word. It can also mean dead on arrival.
Correct. I think the heart of the problem is that the five biggest banks make a huge amount of money from the derivatives business, and they make that money in large part because the business is opaque, and they would like to keep it opaque. I think there's a bigger underlying problem, which is that for a long time, the argument was that derivatives actually reduce risk in the financial system by spreading it around. As we've seen in crises, they don't reduce risk. They exacerbate and increase risk. And I think that's something that our modern financial system has yet to come to terms with. I'm not sure that there's even a regulatory regime that could come to terms with something that people created but can't always understand.
Alan Blinder, why is this opaqueness still allowed? I mean, this has grown and grown even after this. And I was reading, you mentioned Gary Gensler. One of his predecessors as chairman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission was Jim Stone, who wrote not that long ago that the open derivatives positions at the three largest U.S. banks, this was in 2012 already, exceed twice the GNP of the world. And now at that scale, how can that be opaque and anybody assert we have anything like oversight or regulation?
Well, first, on the reason for the opacity, what Bethany said is exactly right. You've got a handful of banks. She said five, and there are a bunch in Europe as well and in Japan. But it's a relatively small number of banks that make a huge amount of money by keeping these derivatives from being standardized and traded on organized exchanges.
Why do we allow that? They have enough money. Why do we allow that?
We should not.
But we do. We haven't done anything about that in 5 years.
The answer is lobbying strength. There's a lot of money at stake. and the lobbyists have tied this thing up in knots, and that's, you know, that's sort of why I brought up Gary Gensler's lonely battle.
Yeah, but you know your history, Professor. There, Wall Street was a big deal in the 20s. There was a lot of wealth in the 20s. Why were in the 1930s the U.S. government was able to, and politicians were able to come together and do fixes that lasted for the better part of a century, and now in 5 years, why are lobbyists more powerful now than then?
Yeah, it's a darn good question. I think part of the answer is there's vastly more money in the industry now relative to the economy than there was then.
I mean, that was the Great Gatsby era. There was a lot of concentrated wealth.
Yeah, I know, but it wasn't quite like today. The finance share of the whole U.S. GDP was not as large then as it is, as it has been. It's receded a little since the crisis, but it's still very large. But the other thing I want to call attention to...
But this gets to concentrated wealth and the people who can wield it.
Yes, and they are. The other thing is we didn't have the PCORA hearings. Now, most people will say, what in the world was that?
Mm-hmm.
These were hearings in the... Now I'm hesitating. I think it was the Senate. Might have been the House. Doesn't matter. Ferdinand PCORA was the general counsel, who was a bit of a showman. But what they did is expose abuses in a very, very public way.
Sort of like the Watergate hearings, laid all that out decades later.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that really helped galvanize political opinion around thoroughgoing reform. We didn't do anything like that. Here we have the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, issued a very good report, by the way, but had a much lower profile. And significantly, we got the order reversed. The Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission reported after Dodd-Frank had passed.
Yeah.
So we had already done the law.
Right. And that was it. And we were done. People clamoring to get in here with you, Alan Blinder, and you, Bethany McLean. John in Watertown, Connecticut. You're on the air, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Actually, my point was just what your panel brought up. And then until we can control the lobbying, the greed that these people want to protect in the banking industry is just never going to go away. And as long as they have that financial voice in Congress and with the Senate and in Washington as a whole, we're heading for an absolute another one of these problems.
How do you get around it, John? Because all those billions are piled up. They've got them. They're doing great business now. They're accumulating more money. How do you get around the amplitude of their voice in Washington?
I think that goes to another program that you'll probably have to have and already have had, because I listened to you for quite a bit, and that's about a lobbying reform. I mean, I don't know how you get around it until you take that voice away. I mean, 1% of this country right now possesses 23% of the wealth, and I don't have the facts, but I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if the vast majority of that wealth is helped somehow with the financial industry and the people that possess that.
Well, it takes home that big chunk anyway. John, thanks for your call. Bethany, how do we get around the big voice of the Wall Street money that has stood in the way of that kind of, never mind hearing, even the theater of open, really poking and dramatic hearings couldn't be arranged?
Well, I guess I think that one thing that would help is if members of Congress were more financially sophisticated. And all you have to do is, even someone who has a baseline of financial knowledge, as I do, to sit in a hearing to realize that most members of Congress don't grasp the modern financial system. And what that means is that they are incredibly susceptible to lobbying, because the lobbyists seem very reasonable with the arguments they put forward about what damage this is going to do to the financial system, to the American economy, to the standing of American banks all over the world, and it all seems very reasonable, and the lobbyists win.
But we've all gone to school on this in the last 5 years, and it doesn't seem that complicated at bottom.
It shouldn't be that complicated.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about what's been cleaned up and what hasn't on Wall Street 5 years after the shocking collapse of Lehman Brothers and the beginning of the Great Recession, all the pain and loss that has come since then for so many. Bethany McLean is with us, contributing editor at Vanity Fair, columnist for Reuters, contributor at CNBC, co-author of All the Devils Are Here. Alan Blinder is here, professor at Princeton University, served under Bill Clinton as member of the Council of Economic Advisors, was chairman of the Board of Governors of the Fed, author of After the Music Stopped. Lots of callers. Jack in Nashville, Tennessee. Jack, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think the real problem that we're facing in America relative to the financial crisis is the end of the rule of law. We have complete and total regulatory capture of all the agencies, the Congress, the White House. Across the board, we have the industry dictating policy to our government, not our government looking out for our country. And there's been no one prosecuted in the big sense. We had, for example, the executive team from Goldman Sachs perjure themselves under oath to Senator Carl Levin's committee. He referred a 700-page report to the Justice Department, and nothing was done. We had the head of criminal prosecutions at the Justice Department say that he was afraid to prosecute anybody in the big banks because he was afraid what it might do to the financial system. So the rule of law is completely gone. Whether it's accounting fraud, stock fraud, right up and down the line, we have a criminal class that's running the show here, and no one is doing anything about it.
Jack, I get the spirit of what you're saying, but the rule of law is not completely gone. I mean, there's Dodd-Frank with its partial implementation and waiting.
It is gone. Dodd-Frank is a facade. The fact that we are this far out hardly any of the rules proposed and the authorities granted in Dodd-Frank have been enacted should be an indication of the level of corruption in this field in our society.
Jack, I appreciate your call. Bethany, respond to that sentiment and that boiled down by one citizen.
I think the most frightening thing is that a wide swath of citizens with good reason feel exactly the way that Jack does. You cannot have, I'll come back to this, you cannot have a functioning economy without a functioning financial system, and a functioning financial system requires the trust of the citizenry. That's the basis of a modern financial system. And when you have so many people who, for good reason, don't trust the financial system, just look at the continuing slew of bad news out of the banks. Fine for this, multi-million dollar fine for this, charges for this, allegation somebody's rigging the aluminum market, allegation somebody else has rigged the electricity market. You realize this is just, it's an incredibly unhealthy situation for all of us.
We hear that. Caroline in Savannah, Georgia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is more of a comment, I guess, is did we even make a mistake bailing it out and stopping, bringing the financial market back from the cliff? That because the people in power, the people with that are wielding all that money, they had a very temporary, very mild, in the greater sense of things, repercussions.
And 95% of the rebound has gone to, what did we see last week? The top of 10%, 1%. But Caroline, if we'd just let it go to a depression, think of the very real pain that would have cost millions of people. Is it worth that just to bring some pain to the top?
And me too. I mean, I'm not in any way, shape, or form a middle-class person. I'm a working student.
Yeah.
You know, I'm poor too. And it would have hurt me too. But you know, it's like ripping off the Band-Aid, which is a super simplistic way of saying it.
Yeah.
But during the Depression, those people lost all their money, and they had incentive to fix things. And that's why we got something that worked for 75 years.
Caroline, I really appreciate your call. Alan Blinder, I mean, I hear the sincerity of what Caroline's saying, honestly, it makes me kind of sick that American citizens have to think the self-punishment that would come for millions in the desperate hope to get at those who are sort of playing the system here. That's the only way to get something done is to burn the whole house down. What does that say about our political system?
Well, it says a number of things, including especially that the case for doing what we did was never really made by anyone in authority in an important way. You didn't hear it from President Bush or Secretary Paulson in a very coherent way. You didn't hear it even from President Obama and Secretary Geithner in a coherent
way. For TARP, for the interventions. But Caroline's point is deeper than that. I mean, she doesn't mind if they worked, but she's desperate for a way to get at the heart of resistance to reform, which is still sitting there loaded and with its lobbyists playing the organ.
Well, I think what I was going to say, the other aspect goes back to your previous callers, which is a lot of Americans are quite justified in being angry that basically nobody was prosecuted for this set of, let's just call them crimes, quote unquote, whether they're actually criminal is for courts of law.
Do you share that sentiment or not?
I do share that sentiment. I mentioned this in the book. in explaining the backlash against the policy, which you're hearing from lots of Americans, that they look around and said, nobody went to jail for this? How could that be? And I think they're absolutely right to think that. Now, in terms of the lobbyists, you go back two questions ago.
Mm-hmm.
Lobbying is, for better or for worse, protected by the Constitution, as you know. So we can't say no lobbying. But I think the closest thing we can do to that, which we should do, but of course we're paralyzed from doing it now, is campaign finance reform. If elections involved a lot less money, if it was publicly provided, et cetera,
yeah,
the lobbyists would have a lot less purchase on the legislature.
Of course, lobbyists will go after any effort like that as well. Mm-hmm. This is really fundamental stuff.
Oh, yeah.
This is a power play. Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call. I just do want to point out that until we have a different character of people running for public office, until we have people that have character and courage to stand up to the money, whether the money is there or not, we're glad the money's there.
Yeah.
Money works for people.
Sure.
People shouldn't be working for money. Money should be working for people. And we have a problem with courage. Everybody's got the excuse that money talks and you know what walks. And the problem is we're not looking at the ground level, growing our economy from the ground up. Ending cannabis prohibition is one of these ways that these politicians have no courage, and that would reinforce our manufacturing economy from the ground up.
Bob, I take your point. I don't know about the origin of the vision, but I definitely take it. I mean, the funny thing here, Bethany, is that Americans aren't asking for some kind of, you know, communist revolution. Most Americans want capitalism that just works right and isn't wrapped around too big to fail and very narrow interests.
And I think that's a very telling thing. To me, when you look at the crisis, the question isn't, well, it is a question, but the most important question isn't, was it criminal? Is it criminal? Can we criminalize it? A senior banker actually described the financial crisis to me as the greatest heist in human history, because never before had so many people made so much money while doing so much damage. And to me, that's the proof that capitalism didn't work. So many people made fortunes, not for creating, but for destroying large swaths of our economy, not for building long-term businesses that created value for the country, but for building businesses that were going to collapse. And that tells me that something is broken. I have nothing against people making a fortune for creating a business that works for supplying jobs to people. But when you see this happening, people getting paid for failure, there's something wrong. There's something deeply wrong.
Ellen Blender, I want to keep this somewhat specific as well. Let's pick up another piece that was bemoaned after the collapse and still not really fixed, proprietary trading. This is when banks gamble with FDIC-insured funds. So where are we on fixing that up, Ellen?
Someplace in purgatory. This is an example of what I was speaking about before. The Dodd-Frank Act embodied the so-called Volcker Rule, which is very clear. Proprietary trading has to be outside of banks, so there is no gambling with FDIC-insured and hence taxpayer-insured.
Okay, nice money. And clean. Where does it stand?
Perfectly clean. Now, we are now 3.25 years after the passage of Dodd-Frank, and the regulators, there are a whole host of regulators that have to be involved in this, are still trying to come up with a viable translation of that dictum into concrete law that could be enforced. Here's the rub. Whether trading is proprietary or for making markets is a clean conceptual distinction, but next to impossible to tell in concrete instances.
They say it's for making markets, so we need to have this money available to sort of work around here and to make a market,
right,
to make the whole thing work.
That's right.
You say that's murky, and a lot of how we address this may fall to the next Federal Reserve chief. We're going to have a new one before long.
Yes.
What about that? Larry Summers is out of that running now. He just withdrew.
Yes.
What's the the impact of that? What about Janet Yellen?
Well, my guess, since it looks like it was a two-horse race and one horse dropped out, that the next Fed chief will be Janet Yellen. Now, it's always possible. The president hasn't said that, and it's always possible some dark horse comes in and becomes Fed chief. But it's important. The federal chief is just one among many regulators, but he or she is the primus inter pares, is the most important person. And I think it's quite important that the next head of the Fed, whoever he or she is very firm on getting Dodd-Frank done. There's a lot of loose ends that still need to be done, and it needs to be cleaned up, promulgated, and set to work.
Then who knows if that's enough, but that would be something. Pat in Hancock, Michigan. Pat, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
One of your guests talked about not having one single bad guy. Don't you think it would be good to be looking at the banking industry for an institutional flaw in corruption?
Well, yes, but I mean, the complaint has been that if you don't ever bring it down to individuals, including individuals who make, let's remember, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, nobody has the, you know, fear of God in them. But let me hold your point, Pat, and get one more. Mike in New Orleans. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My only comment is I wonder if anyone has considered that maybe nothing was happening and that this was just the administration's last-ditch attempt to just fleece more money out of the government before stepping out of office.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. What administration? When? What do you mean, fleece?
The Bush administration, at the end of 2008, asked for roughly $1 trillion with no oversight, and they needed it the day after tomorrow. And
well, but Alan Blinder says that looks better than a Great Depression. Maybe we'd all still be selling apples on the street corner.
Well, maybe nothing was happening at all, and we've all been fleeced, including the...
You think this is a fake moon landing scenario? I don't know.
I believe in the moon landing, but I'm not sure I believe that we needed $1 trillion spent without any oversight in 2 or 3 days. That was the claim that Paulson made, a guy who's...
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I get that, and there was, as Alan and Bethany say, sure, there was a rush to get it done, and maybe it wasn't perfect. But I think overall I'm hearing from our good guest this hour that saved us a lot of woe. But, I mean, the suspicion sits right there. One more. John in Westford, Massachusetts. John, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I know we're running late. I just wanted to echo some of your earlier callers and thank you for putting on this program. I think the crisis in the financial markets are not going to be resolved until we have some closure on who the perpetrators were, how this happened, and how can we get rid of the people who are in the system that are causing these problems. I mean, in any business, when a business fails, the management team has to be taken out. The board members that are responsible for oversight have to exercise their fiduciary responsibilities, whether it's done through the court systems, whether it's the attorney general.
Yeah.
People are frustrated and don't trust the system, so I just want to make that point. Hopefully there's some further comments or something.
Yeah, clean it out. But, of course, there are a lot of the same players there. Alan Blinder, one more practicality. Right at the heart of this was the rating agencies. These credit rating agencies contributed so big by giving these five-star ratings to junk. And you say, after all the talk, as we sit here today, rating agencies are still compensated as they were on the day Lehman Brothers crashed.
This is one of the things I mentioned in the Wall Street Journal article that I think, you know, if a Martian came down and you told him that, he would say, you have to be kidding. That can't be true, but it is true. Congress, in doing Dodd-Frank, couldn't agree on what to do about the rating agencies, so they ordered studies by the GAO and by the SEC. The GAO has delivered a study that's been gathering dust. The SEC has still not delivered its study more than 3 years after the fact. And so by default, while we could change it, the old system remains. And I think that's a disgrace.
Bethany, what about compensation? You know, again, Jim Stone, former head of the Community Commodity Futures Trading Commission, wrote a couple years ago saying that in the old days, institutions of finance used to help the country get through inevitable economic cycles. Profits from good years were retained as capital in banks and brokerages available to cushion lean years. And then they ramped up their own supercharged compensation, and there was no money in the bank when the bad times came. Should we regulate to assure that cyclical gains are not paid out in compensation as a taxpayer backstopped, financial gift?
Boy, I think that's tricky with publicly traded financial firms, which is maybe is the heart of the issue. And I do agree. I think compensation is the key to all of this. Unless you get the incentive system right, people will continue to do what they're incentivized to do. And if people can get paid fortunes for making short-term gains that later turn into losses, then go for those short-term gains, they will. There have been lots of reforms to compensation in the wake of the crisis. Bankers are getting paid more deferred stock, meaning that their pay is dependent on the well-being of the institution, at least over some period of time. The problem is that the history of compensation reform is littered with examples of unintended consequences, and every attempt at fixing compensation seems to end up putting more money in people's hands.
But watch this space, because it hasn't always been this way. You end up saying it seems that people responsible, Bethany, for risk management are right now just piling on more risk.
I'm not sure they're piling on more risk. I think even risk managers don't always understand the risks they're taking. To me, the heart of the problem is the complexity of this modern financial system.
Maybe we need to step in and simplify. Bethany McLean, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair in San Francisco, great to have you. Bethany, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Blinder at Princeton University, thank you, Alan.
Glad to be with you.
Listeners, there's the story. Now, what do you do about it? There it is, all laid out. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.